Mm-hmm.
And you get there just at daybreak, about 7:15 in the morning or so, just as it's getting light. The reason for this is that Ascension is not really big enough. Well, Ascension was an island that was formed by 40 active volcanoes in 36 square miles. Ascension was discovered. The reason I call it Ascension, it was discovered on Ascension Day, whatever that is. I believe it's a Catholic holiday. 1501 was when it was discovered. And the theory is that on the surface of the Earth, that's the newest land mass to have appeared. Now, they don't know exactly what year it erupted, but the volcanoes have been extinct since it was discovered, which was 1501, so the volcanoes are thoroughly extinct. You know, there's no problem with them. But you can practically count the 40 volcanoes. Well, no, it was 41 volcanoes, I guess it was, in 36 square miles. And you can practically count them. Some of the craters are very distinct, others are not. But the biggest, well, three volcanoes clustered right in the middle of the island formed a thing called Green Mountain, and that's the only place on the island that anything will grow. And Green Mountain is 5,000 feet tall, and growth only starts at about the 3,000 foot level and then goes the rest of the way up. The rest of the island is nothing but volcanic cinder. And they advise you when you go down there to take a pair of shoes, but they advise you when you're outside walking around to wear these shower shoes. And they sold us, you know, these rubber shower shoes.
Yeah.
They sell them in the PX for 25 cents a pair so that we wouldn't spend a lot of money on shoes. Because that volcanic cinder is very hard and very sharp.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wear a regular pair of leather-soled shoes, you'll walk right through the soles in 3 or 4 weeks. You'll be right through the soles of the shoes.
Mm-hmm.
While I was there, later on, I went to a couple of schools and I came back and I became a radar supervisor. And because I was a radar supervisor, I had my own truck, my own personal pickup truck, and in addition to the truck the crew used to go back and forth to work. Well, they took my truck off the boat. It was a Ford pickup truck, and they put it up on the dock, and they drove it to the transportation department where they checked it out and made sure it had the right oil and everything. It was brand new. It only had 6 miles on it. And it had regular U.S. type street tires on it. In 3 weeks, I had worn out the front tires on that truck because the cinder was so sharp and so abrasive. No rainfall. You get the statistics on Ascension. It rains on the main part of the island. Now, it rains all the time up on the mountain. That's why it's all green. And the British have a big place there where they do cables relay, and the water comes from these concrete basins that are built up on Green Mountain, and they pipe the water down to Georgetown, which is and also the British have a farm up on Green Mountain where they grow vegetables and they raise cows and all kinds of stuff up there.
Oh, is that big?
Well, yeah. Yeah, the whole island's only 36 square miles, but the Green Mountain part is pretty good size. And the Americans, of course, can't catch enough. Well, even the British can't get enough water up there. I mean, they get enough, but it's not very comfortable for them. So the Americans distill seawater. We pump seawater into these big tanks and filter it, and then pump it into these distillation units, and then pump it back into freshwater tanks, make fresh water out of that, and pump the brine back into the ocean. And we figured that it cost about 11 cents a gallon for water, but by the time you've distilled it and pumped it and filtered it and treated it and all that stuff. And they used to make us wash our trucks. Every week you had to wash your truck. And you used water that cost 11 cents a gallon to wash your truck. The British were just, you know, just living all the time. The British just despised us because here they were catching water up on the mountain and they were limited to 4 gallons per person per day. And we're sitting there with these big diesel distillation guns. We're washing our truck in distilled water. And but it really, I got down there, and I stepped off the plane, and I nearly threw up. I thought to myself, God, this is the ugliest island I've ever seen. And the reason that you have to land in the daylight is that the runway is carved out from between two hills. So the runway is 7,000 feet long, but it goes uphill 3,500 feet till it crests over these two hills, and then it goes downhill for 3,500 feet.
Wow.
When a plane passes the middle of the runway, he's only the Globemaster, which has got a wide wingspan on it. When he passes the middle of the runway, when he passes between those two mountains, there's only 6 feet of clearance on each wing. So he's got to be right down the middle of the runway, or it's going to rip a wing off on the mountain. You know? The mountain is just covered. Both mountains are covered with red lights. But they will not allow a plane carrying passengers to land or take off during the dark. So what he's got to do, he's got to get to Ascension right at daylight. He unloads his cargo and his passengers. He takes on the outgoing cargo and the outgoing passengers. But he's got to be able to get off the ground, get halfway to Recife, and turn around and come back before it gets dark. In other words, he's got to be able to take off. If he doesn't take off in time enough to reach the point of no return and come back and still be in daylight, then he's got to wait till the next day to take off. In other words, it's an emergency procedure. He's got to be able to get halfway, or just a little less than halfway, to Recife and turn around and come back and be able to get back before it gets dark in case he has an emergency.
Yeah,
I see.
Which
is also not a very comforting thought, but that's you know, they cover all these alternatives. And so here you land on this island, you know, and it's a funny sensation when you land, because you can actually feel yourself going uphill, and you press the top of this hill and go down the other side, which is a very strange runway. Then he turns around and he taxis back, and the airport is on probably, well, there's really no worse part of the island, but the airport is miles from the base. Well, not miles, but a mile maybe from the base. And there's nothing there but this stupid looking hangar, you know, in this ugly bus. And it was just, you know, it's a gruesome sight. But the base is very nice. There's no need for air conditioning because it never rains on Ascension. The humidity never gets high. The humidity stays 45 or 50% all the time, which is very comfortable. The temperature never goes above 75 and never goes below 65. So
it
hovers in the 70s all the time, and it never rains. So, you know, there's no real need for air conditioning. You can open your windows, and there's always a breeze blowing naturally right out there in the middle of the ocean.
Now, you were still working for RCA.
Yeah.
And something happens now that to get anywhere, you've got to go back to school.
Yeah. RCA says to me, I went, when I... On Grand Bahama, I was a clerk and I was communications coordinator. When I came back to Ascension, I was an electronic technician B. Then I was promoted to electronic technician A. Then I was promoted to chief technician. Then I was promoted to radar leader.
And cold water if you want it.
And then RCA says to me, all right, you can be, and we want you to be, radar manager. But you have to go to another island to be radar manager. Now, by now, I've been on Ascension for 26 months, and I love it. I don't even want to leave, you know.
No.
It's
well,
very strange. It's
oh,
very strange that you could like a place like
yeah.
that. But they handpick the people they send to Ascension because they don't want to have any troubles.
Yeah.
As it is, they had a murder while I was there. One guy broke a beer bottle and murdered another guy. But both those guys worked for Western Electric, not RCA. And they were down there to build a special radar. And Western Electric's not as careful about who they send. So fortunately, you get a fantastically compatible group of people. Plus, while I was down there, I discovered I always knew from history classes and stuff that Napoleon was exiled to an island called St. Helena, you know. But that's about all I knew, you know, St. Helena. So it's somewhere in the South Atlantic Ocean, you know. Our laborers on Ascension, the kids who worked in the motor pool and the houseboys who cleaned your room and the kids who worked in the laundry and the kids who worked in the dining hall, you know, cooking the food and washing the dishes, were all St. Helenian kids.
Oh.
RCA and Pan American said you got to be 16 years old to come from St. Helena to Ascension Island to work, but there was this one kid in the motor pool who was only 13. But they fake their birth certificate so they can, and we pay them better than any job they could make, you know, on St. Helena. And they're the nicest people I've ever seen. Their skin color goes from completely white, blue-eyed, blonde hair people to coal black, kinky-haired, wide-nosed, you know, just all the Negro characteristics. Their background or their ethnic makeup is a little bit of everything. They're mainly East Indian. Now, to me, Indians are not, East Indians are not very attractive people. But these people were extremely attractive, males and females both. Everybody was just, most of them were strikingly beautiful or handsome. Of course, we only saw guys down in Ascension because we didn't bring any girls down there to work, naturally. But the British would bring families up from St. Helena to work. In other words, a man and his wife and all their kids. And so you did see some of the female St. Helenians. But see, the British brought their families there to work, and we weren't allowed. In other words, no wives, no dependents were allowed in Ascension. So, from an American point of view, so our base was all guys, and naturally the kids we hired from St. Helena were all males. But,
and you were there 26 months?
Yeah, I stayed 26 months, not continuously,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
It was back and forth for vacations and stuff, but I stayed a total of 26 months. And
they were going to make you into it.
During that 26 months, I made a trip down to St. Helena. The boats, there's no runways on St. Helena. There's no air service to St. Helena, so the only way to get there is by ship. And it so happened that during the time I was there, a ship was going to go south to St. Helena. Takes almost 2 days. It's about 800 miles. Then 7 days later, another ship was going to come north. So I could go to St. Helena, spend a week, and come back without being gone from work too long. And I did, and it was... Someday I'll have to show you those slides. I got a lot of slides at St. Helena.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Which is something you don't see because nobody goes there, you know?
Yeah.
It's a fascinating island, and the people are super friendly. You know, like we were invited, when we first got there, people looked at us like we were kind of strange, you know, and I thought, God, this is going to be terrible, you know, 7 days of these people looking at us like we're some kind of freak. But what it was, they didn't know who we were, what we were there for. All I knew was we were Americans, and what on earth were Americans doing there, you know? Well, the ship that we traveled on also was bringing the mail, you see, so... It takes a few hours to get the mail off the ship and get it to the post office and get it put up and delivered. And you could almost feel the complexion change as soon as the mail was delivered. And these people started opening these letters from their sons on Ascension saying, you know,
yeah,
my friends have come to St. Helena and I want you to treat them right, you know. And the phone started ringing. They've got one hotel on the island. The phone started ringing at the hotel. And we were getting invited to cocktail parties and to dinner parties, and they had it very well organized. In order for the St. Helenians to make the maximum use of our time, nobody would expect you, say, to come for cocktails and have dinner and then stay for coffee and then, you know, for maybe after dinner drinks. Everybody divided you up. You went somewhere for cocktails before dinner.
Oh, yeah.
Then you went somewhere for dinner. Then you went somewhere else for coffee and dessert. Then you went somewhere else for after dinner drinks. By the time you got finished with this evening routine, you were plastered, you know, just completely staggering drunk. But you, because nobody would forgive you for not, you know, having lots of drinks. And I didn't run into a non-drinker anywhere down there. There probably are some, but if they were, I didn't run into them anywhere. Their food is highly seasoned, and that was kind of hard on my digestive system. I managed to last until the last day, and then I got terribly sick the last day. I guess it all just sort of built up on me. But it was a fantastic trip, and I shot, I think I took 200 or 300 slides, some of which I have called out, but I've got it all set up and set. Sometime when I'm coming, I'll bring a projector in. So RCA said, you know, we want you to be radar manager, but you got to go to another island, which I wasn't too. Oh, also, in addition to working for RCA, I was, we had a bar and a grill, and I was assistant manager of the bar and grill. It was something to do, you know. I didn't need the money. RCA was paying me $11,000 and something a year, and I was putting all of that in the bank. But the job at the club paid $175 a month, and but it was interesting because my job as assistant manager, I was in charge of hiring and firing the bartenders. Now, most of the bartenders were St. Louisians, and we hired them after their normal duty hours with RCA. But we had four bartenders that worked for us full time, and they would clean the club during the day and get it ready to open. We opened at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and stayed open until 2 o'clock in the morning. And then we'd supplement the bartenders. The bar was 150 feet long. And on Saturday night, we had to have 11 bartenders.
Oh, my. Everybody.
And there's only 500 people on the island.
Uh-huh. They were all there.
500 Americans. There were several hundred British, but the British would come to our club, too. We saw 9 movies a week. Pan American would ship us 9 movies every week. And, you know, so Friday night and Saturday night, we'd have a double feature. No, I didn't have time to go to the movies. I had to work in the club. But I had to hire and fire the bartenders, and I had to keep the inventory of booze and cokes and all the other stuff that goes with running a bar, which was not as easy as it sounds because our shipping schedule was irregular. We couldn't afford to have booze flown in because it was too expensive, so you had to resort to ocean freight. And the ships from England were fairly regular. You could depend on getting a ship from England about every 3 months. But ships from New York were erratic. We had a contract with Moore McCormick Lines, and if the cargo at New York got to a certain level, then Moore McCormick had to send the ship to Ascension whether they were coming there or not. In other words, they had to make a special trip ship and a special trip to go from New York to Cape Canaveral to Ascension Island. Now, they could do anything they wanted with that ship in the meantime. In other words, if they wanted it to go, you know, somewhere else, it could go there. But they had to guarantee when the cargo got to a certain level at New York or at Cape that they would leave. But any time they had a ship going in that direction, they could take whatever cargo was there because you only pay for what they actually ship. So if they had a ship going to Africa, they would stop at New York and Port Canaveral and pick up whatever cargo we had, even if it was nothing, you know. But then they were always guaranteed that when the cargo got to a certain level, they would have to send the ship. Well, that made it kind of erratic. You might get 2 ships in a row, and then you might not get another one for 6 months. So I could get scotches and certain kinds of liqueurs and gin from England on what they called the Round Africa boat, which was every 3 months. I got Seagram's and Hiram Walker and General Distillers from New York. The Seagram's and Hiram Walker in Canada would ship the stuff to New York in bond, and then whenever the Moore McCormick ship left, they took whatever booze I had at New York and brought it. We got champagne and vodka the round Africa boats operated clockwise around Africa and counterclockwise around Africa. This was a British shipping line. So on the counterclockwise boats, I would get gin and scotch from England, and on the clockwise boats, I'd get vodka and champagne from South Africa. Now, I got rum from Recife, and they used to sneak it on the Air Force planes for me and fly it in. And it wasn't very good rum, and when they started having the trouble in Cuba, the Bacardi people moved from Cuba to Recife, Brazil. They put a distillery right in Recife. And I went over one day. You wouldn't believe how cheap liquor is when you can avoid all these taxes mm-hmm. and stuff on it. I went to Brazil one day, one weekend, in order to make arrangements to get rum, because I had heard they had built a Bacardi plant, distillery, whatever you call it. So I went to Recife and I caught a cab and I went out to the bottling plant and I said, you know, I'd like to order rum. Also, you couldn't believe the quantities of liquor they consumed down there. And the guy says, oh, that's fine, you know, how are we going to get it to you? And I said, well, you ship it on consignment through the Brazilian Air Force, but the Brazilian Air Force then turns it over to the U.S. Air Force and it's shipped. And he said, okay. He was willing to make those arrangements. So his trucks only had to take it out to the Brazilian Air Force base. But I had to work that legally through the Air Force. So they charged me to fly it over there, but it wasn't very much. He said, how much will you be wanting? And I said, well, I'm not supposed to ship liquor on the passenger planes. In the meantime, they had changed the flight schedule. They added a passenger plane. So we had three planes a week, two cargo planes and a passenger plane. Whereas when I first went down there, you flew on the cargo plane, you know, one of the two cargo planes. I said, I'm not allowed to ship booze on the passenger plane, but I want on each of the cargo planes, I would like booze shipped every time a cargo plane leaves, which was every Tuesday and every Thursday. And he said, how much would you like each time? And I said, well, I'd like 30 cases every Tuesday and 30 cases every Thursday. And I said, if I get too much, then I'll let you know and you can just stop for a while completely. And then when my inventory goes down, I said, I'll let you know and you can start again. But I said, you can depend on any shipment being at least 30 cases. So he said, okay, I'll tell you what we'll do. He said, we'll ship 30 cases of light on Tuesday and 30 cases of dark on Thursday, because I wanted both light and dark rum, and he's all said, that's fine. So I said, how much will that be? And he said, well, and he got on his calculator, and he said, are you going to pay in American dollars or Brazilian cruzeiros? And I said, well, I've got a bank account in Brazil, I've got a bank account in England, I've got a bank account in Canada, I've got a bank account in the United States, and I've got a bank account in South Africa. So I said, I can pay you in South African rands, Brazilian cruzeiros, American dollars, Canadian dollars, or British pounds. And he said, pay me in American currency, because he said, that way I don't have to worry about the fluctuating exchange rate on the cruzeiros. And I said, okay, so I said, how much will that be? And he figured and he figured and he figured and he said, that'll be $4.80 a case. I said, you don't mean $4.80 a bottle? He said, no. I said, you have made some mistake somewhere. And he said, no. He said, it'll be $4.80 a case. So I said, okay. I said, 40 cents a bottle? He said, you know. And I even took 30 times 4.80, and I said, this is what each shipment will cost me. And he said, yeah. So I want to make sure he hadn't made a mistake. I assumed that for 40 cents a bottle for Bacardi rum that I was going to get fifths, you know. But halfway back to Ascension, it occurred to me, maybe he thought I was talking about half pints or pints or something like that, you know. But even the smallest bottle I've ever heard of, except a miniature, would have easily been worth 40 cents, so I didn't worry about it, you know. When we got the first shipment in, I opened the box. The bottles looked like quarts, but they were a little bit too big to be quarts. They were imperial quarts, 40 ounces. Each bottle was 40 ounces for 40 cents.
Well, you couldn't afford not to drink it.
The Air Force, yeah, it was cheaper than the water. The Air Force charged me $12 a case to fly it over there, which was another dollar a bottle. But even at that, you know. I was paying $1.40 for 40 ounces of Bacardi and getting it flown in. 1,200 and some odd miles it was being flown. And I asked him, I wrote back and forth to that man time after time after time, and I said, I'm not anxious to pay any more for the rum than I have to, but I said, are you sure you haven't made some kind of mistake? And he said, no, that's what it sounds like.
Well, I'm surprised
I was
you ever left
to
being,
well, that was the point, wasn't it? We'll get there eventually. RCA says to me, you can be a radar manager, and your salary would be $15,000 a year. But you must go to another island, because they didn't feel it was desirable for me to be. You see, the when I went from BTEC to ATEC, most of the guys I worked with were still BTEC. And in fact, when I went to Radar Leader, a lot of the guys that had worked with me were still BTECs or ATECs. In other words, I had gone past them, and they felt that to make me radar manager wouldn't have been not desirable, since I had grown up, so to speak, with these same guys. So they thought that it was better to send me to another island. So we made all the arrangements. I took the correspondence course that they wanted me to take, which was some kind of management development course from some company in New York. And I passed all of that, and they called it their management development program. And they were going to send me back to Grand Bahama, and they had another chief tech on Grand Bahama, or leader on Grand Bahama, that they were ready to make radar manager, and they were going to send him to Ascension. So in other words, we were just going to change places. And but in telling me that, they also told me, they said, now that's as far as you're going without a degree. He's radar manager. And I said, without a degree in what? And they said, well, we don't care, just get a degree. And I said, just a bachelor's degree? And they said, yeah, bachelor's degree. And I said, in anything? And they said, in anything. So their theory was that somehow you're a better person for having a bachelor's degree. I don't know, you know. I still don't understand that. But anyway, I'm no better now than I now that I've got a master's degree than I was without any of the degrees, as far as RCA would be concerned. But anyway, I said that's, I'm not sure that radar manager isn't good enough, but I'm really sure it wouldn't be good later. So right in the middle of all this, all of a sudden, this bug bit me at 20, God, my, then I must have been 28. So I said, I'm going back to school. My replacement had already come to Grand Bahama. To Ascension. They were waiting for me at Grand Bahama to be radar manager, and right in the middle of all this shifting around, I said, I'm going back to school. I know they could have killed me, you know, because they had to scratch around now and find another radar manager for Grand Bahama. So I went up to my replacement had come in. Now I'm a very methodical and a very organized person, you know. And when we had, in our radar building, it was three stories, not including the roof, which is where all the equipment was, I mean all the antenna. To have a successful missile shot and get the data we were supposed to get, it took 11 people. Every person had a job to do, and then that person had a backup job. In other words, everybody did what they were supposed to do, but everybody was checking to see that somebody else did what they were supposed to do, what somebody else was supposed to do. In other words, my own roommate was supposed to turn on the Sanborn recorder, but his job was to make sure that whoever was supposed to turn on the Borsheim camera turned it on at the proper time. And everything was timed out so that you didn't have to do two things at once. In other words, the Sanborn recorder went on way ahead of time, and it started recording all its whatever it recorded. And to turn on the Borsheim camera, you it only had 1,000 feet of film in it, so you turned on the Borsheim camera at the last minute. So the guy who turned on the Sanborn recorder, his backup was kind of, well, anyway, the new guy came in and he didn't believe in all that organization. And where we had been getting 98, 99, and 100% of the data we were supposed to get, this new guy comes in and he says, well, he said, I believe everybody is adult and they should know what they're supposed to do. I said, well, now there's a lot going on. He had never worked on a test where the missile was going to make its terminal dive, and you only had like minutes to get all the data you had to get, because you couldn't, you know, it's not as if it was going to start way over there and go way over there. It's going to come straight down, and it does it fast. See, in Grand Bahama, you're tracking it from launch, and you're tracking it way down range, and there's no hurry, you know. And I said, it's a little different down here. He said, oh, no. He said, everybody knows what they're supposed to do. Well, it was utter chaos during the test. The people, now, part of the problem was none of the guys liked this new guy, so they weren't very cooperative with him. But my own roommate didn't even turn on the, he turned on the Sanborn recorder, but he didn't turn on the pen. So the Sanborn recorder used miles of paper just drawing four straight lines right down the paper, which didn't mean a thing to anybody. We got 22 or something like that, 24% of the data we were supposed to get. So there was a big inquisition, you know, everybody had to fly to Patrick and explain why we had done so poorly on this test. But I was quitting, you know. I mean, I didn't have the attitude I'm quitting, so I don't care, but, you know, I knew I was quitting and they couldn't pin anything on me. Besides, I was just a spectator. I had already been relieved, you know. But they asked me not to get this new guy in trouble. So anyway, that was my last. I went early. In order to process out my termination, you know, and also attend this hearing about this test. And that was that's another story. The plane, my last flight back to the States, we had little minor engine problems like oil leaks and stuff like that, which I think were mostly imaginary. But we took off from Recife going back north to the States, and we threw a prop on one of the engines and had to turn around and go back to Recife. And we had to wait 3 days for a prop, and because there was something damaged in the engine when the prop came off, so we had to wait for parts for the engine plus the new prop. And we finally got the plane fixed. We landed in Dutch Guiana, and the guy flying the plane, who was a brand new second lieutenant who must have just been out of pilot school, nearly crashed the plane in Brazil in Dutch Guiana with all of us in it, and he blew all the hydraulic seals out of the nose gear. He landed the plane right on his nose.
Oh.
And we were 3 days in Dutch Guiana waiting for a new nose gear. So it took us 9 days to go from Ascension back to the States when it's supposed to take 3 days. And so the Inquisition was late and everybody was upset. I was late because I was supposed to be in Gainesville, so God.
Yeah.
So
you
I
went against the angel.
And
oh.
I think, you see, that when I was suspended 14 years ago or whenever it was, I was suspended for one semester. So it's been 8 years since I've been gone 8 years. I thought certainly that's at least one semester. So I come diddy bopping back to Gainesville. Here I am. I'm ready to go back to school again. And they say to me, we've changed the rules since you were here last, and you are so deficient in grade points from 8 years ago now that you're not going to be permitted to attend the University of Florida. Here, I quit my job, you know, and I think
and
to myself, well, that's kind of extreme, you know, and I, after all, I am paying taxes, and I am a Florida resident, so I got mad, and I started going here and there, and finally, I find out through some friendly professor somewhere along the line that if I get some college to sponsor me, I can get back into school. So then I have to decide, you know, like, what do I want to do? Well, I decided I wanted to get a degree in accounting. So I went to the bus end college, and I said, you know, I need a sponsor. So I had to go to every department chairman. And I had to get, you know, this committee was going to meet, which composed of all the department chairmen, and they were going to chairman, and they decided they were going to decide whether I could come back to school. So rather than just like try to call them or write them a letter or something, I went from one department to another. I started with accounting, and I sat there in the office until somebody would see me. Some days I spent half a day in an office reading magazines and twiddling my thumbs and waiting. And finally they took pity on me and they said, okay, send him in. You know, I mean, if he's going to sit out there all day, we'll have to talk to him. And I talked to every department head. And so the committee met and I got back in school and with the College of Business Administration sponsoring me. So I had to find a faculty sponsor, a faculty member who would be my sponsor. But I knew none of the department chairmen would want to do that. So I started, and I don't know how I wound up with him, but I wound up with Ralph Thompson in marketing. Marketing wasn't even my field, but I wound up with Ralph Thompson. And Ralph Thompson says, well, he said, it's not really as bad. I don't know if you know Ralph Thompson. He's in the Gainesville Little Theater. He's really a strange character. He says, oh, he says, I don't think you're as bad off as you think you are. And I said, it's not what I think, it's what the university thinks. And I think I was deficient, I forget exactly what the figures were now, but I was deficient 78 grade points or something like that, you know. In other words, when I got to graduation, I had to have twice as many grade points as I had hours accumulated. Well, I had so many hours of D&E that I had to make A's and B's to offset all those D's and E's in order to get twice as many grade points as I had hours, you know. And so Ralph Thompson would put me on a trial program every quarter, and he'd say, okay, I want you to take blah, 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 and blah, blah. And he said, in this course, I want you to make an A, in this course, I want you to make an A, in this course, I want you to make an A, but in this course, you can make a B. Big deal, you know. I'm no student. I never have been a student. So I'd work, and I'd sweat, and I wouldn't quite make it. And Ralph would get very irritated with me, and he'd say, all right, you didn't make it, but he said you came close. And then we had this big chart, and I had plussed so many grade points, and so I only had so many more to go. You know, I'd plussed 9, so I'd only have 69 more to go.
That's all that he'd been doing?
You know, it looked like it was going to be forever, you know. I stayed on academic probation all the time. I was on academic probation every quarter I was here. Every trimester. We were on trimester. I went to school a year round. I never stopped. And I think it was twice during those trimesters, I just knew I wasn't going to make it, you know? I mean, I had either goofed off somewhere along the line and wasn't, because once you get behind and you're taking that many hours and trying to make that many grade points, once you get behind, you stay behind. There's just no way to catch up. And I'd get 9 weeks into the quarter or so, and I'd think, I'm not going to make it, you know? I mean, I'm not even going to come close. So I'd get sick. I had this facility for just, you know, making myself sick. Once I even got the mumps. I got viral pneumonia one quarter. And so that would be my excuse to withdraw from school. And I'd withdraw and start back over again. What year did I come back there? I came back in... '63. I finally got my degree in 67. Took me 4 years after I got back, and I was already supposedly had 2 years. I stayed a sophomore until just before I graduated. I went directly from sophomore to senior. I skipped the junior year altogether because I didn't have enough grade points to be a junior. Once in the middle of all this, I got a letter from the registrar, and his attitude was so nasty. He kind of had this attitude of, I've had it with you, and he hadn't anything to do with me, you know. But he said, you will be denied any further admission to the University of Florida. So I was still in University College. So I went running to University College and all the deans and everybody over there. So I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do for you. So So I went back to my sponsoring bus ad and I said, look, they're going to throw me out of school. And I said, it's not as if I'm not making progress on this thing. You know, I mean, I'm closer than I was before. I'm not going as fast as they would like to see me go, but I'm at least I'm getting there. And so he says, well, he said, there's only one thing we can do. And I said, what's that? He said, well, if we take you in the College of Business Administration, he said, the registrar has got no power to say whether you can or can't attend school. And I said, oh, well, you know, how am I going to get them in College of Business Administration when I don't have enough grade points? And he said, well, let's go see the dean. Well, fortunately, one of these lucky things that happens to you without any calculations or malice or forethought or anything, I joined a fraternity called Delta Sigma Pi. It's a professional business fraternity. Fortunately, you don't have to have good grades to get in. And guess who's the sponsor of Delta Sigma Pi? No less the dean of the College of Business Administration. So I go into the dean's office, and he says, oh, I know you. And I said, yeah, we're in the same fraternity. And he said, oh, yeah. And he says, what's your problem? And I said, well, I'm being thrown out of school. And I said, the only way I can stay in school is for you to take me in the College of Business Administration. So he says, well, go get your transcript from University College, all your records and everything. And he said, come see me tomorrow. So we spread all this thing out on the table. And he said, well, he said, I don't think you're as bad off as you think you are. Same line I get from Ralph Thompson. And I said, well, I don't think I'm so bad off either, but I said, the registrar doesn't like me very much, you know. And he says, well, to hell with the registrar. And he signs this form and he puts me in the College of Business Administration. I had so many hours that I went from 2UC to 4BA. I didn't even go through 3 at all. I just went straight to 4 because I had enough hours to be a senior. I'm still on academic probation, because that's the one thing the registrar can do to me, is keep me on academic probation, because I still don't have twice as many grade points as I've got. So in 1965, in July of 1965, the university offers me a job. In the meantime, I'm running out of money, because I've been 3 years trying to get what should normally have taken 1. And so the university offers me a job for $500 a month, which to me then seemed like a small fortune, you know, $500 a month, my God, you know. So, I mean, that wasn't as much as I had made with RCA, but it still seemed like a lot of money. So I took the job, and I took one course each. By then, I guess we'd gone to the quarter system. I took one course each quarter for free because I was a university employee, which was a lot less maddening a pace, you know. All I had to do was worry about making that grade in that one course. The last quarter I was, before I got my degree, which was April of 67, I had to take a course in management. And I was within a few grade points of, I still had less than a 2.0 average. But I had one more course to take, and if I made enough grade points on that one course, I would be just barely to a 2.0, and I could graduate, because that's the last course I needed. That was the last few grade points I needed, and everything was just rosy. So what do? I make a D.
Oh, no!
Got all the way to the end of the course the day before graduation, and I've made a D. So I nearly fainted. My folks were up here to see me graduate, and I just knew I wasn't going to graduate because a D gave me only, I guess it was a 4-hour course. A D gave me 4 grade points, and I needed 6. Now, they didn't tell me that I needed a 2.0 average. They specifically told me you've got to have twice as many grade points as you have hours. So I calculated, no matter how I tried to figure it, I could not come up with those 2 grade points. So I had 2 less grade points than twice as many hours. So they were going to post graduation, commencement was at 2 o'clock in the afternoon or something like that. At 11 o'clock in the morning, the College of Business Administration was going to post on the door a list of people who were graduating. I didn't dare tell my folks that I might not graduate. But I was like, all day long, you know, and my mother kept saying, what's wrong with you? Here I have my camping gown, I just know I'm not going to graduate. So at 10 o'clock, I make an excuse, we've got to go somewhere for a ride or something, and I just happened to go by the College of Business Administration, and I just happened to say, I think I've got to go over here and do something, and I looked at the door, and there was my name on the door. I graduated with a 1.998, and I graduated on academic probation.
Now
I rubbed the university's nose in it because I took the GRE and made a 1200 and went back and got a master's degree. I'm convinced that graduate school is far easier than undergraduate school.
Well, Wayne, let me tell you. Now, this is a little different subject.
That's cute as hell.
We went over. I wish Faye was here because she's the first time she has done it. Now, Debbie's been doing it, and she's pretty well, she's got pretty good muscles, but I just want you to see how it goes. Faye and little Faye and Debbie went over to one of our friends over here, Miss Mary. She's a character. Now, I'll give you a little bit on the tape. And Faye Burke had not seen Miss, she'd not seen her. She just heard about her. And she'd read one or two little pieces that Suzanne had done about it. That's all she knew. And we went over to see it. She went over to take some word from Suzanne. And also, she wanted to see her cook a little bit. And the best thing she does, the nicest thing she does, is make biscuits. So now that was the situation. Now, Debbie and Faye went over there and spent 2 or 3 hours just listening, then came back and reported on it and set it down on a piece of paper. Now, you listen to Debbie a little bit on that telephone. While they were there, they had this telephone call. You listen to it.
Well, Miss Mary's husband, you have to understand that her husband is quiet. Miss Mary is anything but quiet. But her husband is very quiet, and he just kind of backs her up all the time, you know, and he just loves it. You watch him when she's performing something, and he's just got his eyes going like this, you know, and he's smiling all the time. He loves it. But we were sitting at the table. It'd been storming. We were having the biscuits. Finally, she'd made them and taken them out of the oven, and we were having them. And the phone rang. And Miss Mary picks up the phone, and she says, she's not tall, she's not big, but she's big this way. I mean, you look over her head, but she's huge. And so she kind of, the whole time, she was kind of braced in the chair like this. She couldn't get her legs on the ground, you know, she was kind of braced back like this. And she gets the phone, and she says, it's Bonnie. Oh, Bonnie. And she's letting us know who's on the phone. And Marvin told us, well, that's my brother. That's the wife of my brother-in-law. No, it's my brother, somebody's, anyway, his sister-in-law, I guess. But no, she's married, cousin. She's married to his cousin. And Miss Mary starts in again. She says, well, I'm just sitting right here. I'm sitting here talking about going to Texas because Suzanne was in Texas, and Faye said she was going to take Miss Mary back with her to Texas, you know. And Miss Mary, meanwhile, she's making all these faces on the phone, you know. She's like doing up her face and sticking out her tongue, you know, just like that every time Bonnie says something, you know, so that we're supposed to be catching. It was just amazing. And Marvin was just loving every minute of it. He said, "You tell her." You tell her you can't take her to Texas. Miss Mary said, I can't fit you in my suitcase, Bonnie. And Marvin says, no, you sure couldn't. You couldn't shut the top of it. And then Miss Mary said, what am I going to do with Marvin? And Marvin leans back and he says, well, you just tell her that I don't have to worry about anything. I'm getting younger and handsomer every day. And Miss Mary listens to all this, and she kind of holds the phone away from her ear while she's talking to Bonnie, you know, and she says, yes, well, Marvin is just sitting here right between two gorgeous women, and he is just getting younger and handsomer every day, and I don't have to worry about him. I'm going out there to Texas, and I'm going to get me a divorce from Marvin, and I'm going to get me a Texas, and they said, a Texas Ranger, and this man said, that Texas Ranger.
That's just a piece of it. Now, you're a little sketching bull, Mary.
Oh, the bull. We were talking about their garden. Miss Mary's got a garden up by the house, and Marvin has one farther down. And their neighbor's bull jumped the fence, and it had been jumping the fence and eating their peas. So I asked Miss Mary if they had anything in the garden, and it led into this bull that jumped the fence, and she said no, that the bull, they'd had to take the bull off to market, that they'd made hamburger out of him. And she was really sad about it. You know, she said that was the finest bull there ever was. It was a Brahma bull, a Brimmer bull, big one.
Bramer
bull. I know it was Brimmer.
Brimmer.
I think she
Brimmer.
Does call it Brimmer. She calls it a Brimmer bull. It's a Brimmer bull. And she said that bull
she
was a
She calls
gentleman.
It a Brimmer because I spelled it B-R-A-Y. Brimmer bull.
Uh-huh.
That's what I spelled it. Mm-hmm.
I didn't think you ever took bulls to market. I thought you just left them to...
Well, see, he tested. They have to test them for...
Brucellosis.
Oh.
And he tested out. They had it. And so they had to get rid of it because he had... And it was fun.
And once he tests for you, he won't untest.
There's no cure for him?
But this bull was just... It was. And she said, you know that bull was a gentleman. She said he'd get over in the pea patch and he'd be eating peas. And Marvin would go down there and he'd just speak to him. And that bull would turn right around and go back over the fence. And the amazing thing about the bull was that he jumped the fence like a horse. He would go up to the fence and stand flat-footed and just hop over it like that. He wouldn't run to get up to it, you know. And I was trying to tell Faye this, that this was really an amazing bull, that he didn't just plow through a fence. He hopped over it. And I said, you know, Faye, he jumped fences like a horse. And Marvin said, yeah, you always knew when he was going to jump a fence because he would go in a straight line. If he went in a straight line, it meant he was going to go over whatever was in his way. But if he kind of joggled around a little bit, he wasn't going to jump anything. And if it was a really high fence, just before he got there, he'd give a little jig and then go over. Marvin said the whole time he was showing us with his hand, you know, where the house bull was jumping and everything. And Miss Mary was just, she was really getting worked up about it. And she said that she just wished that somebody had come and taken that bull off. She just wished that that bull had just jumped the fence and gone off somewhere. That was the nicest bull they'd ever had, and she just hated to think of him going off to market. And Marvin said, yeah, you know, they got him to market. He said anybody could have taken him to market. You just put some feed in a truck, and he'd get in, and you could take him off. And the minute the truck started moving, the bull would lie down because he didn't want to be bounced around. When the truck stopped, the bull would stand up and look around, see where he was. And the minute it started again, he'd lie down again. And Miss Mary said he used to come up to their house all the time because he liked people. And Zane, who owned the bull, and his wife both worked, and they'd leave in the morning and they wouldn't come back until late at night. And so the bull jumped the fence and come up to Marvin's, and he'd follow Marvin around all day, just go everywhere Marvin went. And Marvin said, you know, he thought he knew that the bull, that he thought the bull knew he was sick, because he said that the day or 2 days before they tested him, he went off by himself up in the corner and said, no, animals know that. They know that kind of thing. And then he said, you know, they got that bull down to the market, and he jumped every fence they had in the market. And I said, Marvin, those are 11-foot fences. How in the world did he jump them? I thought they were... board fences way up at a stockyard. And Marvin said he just went over every single one just like that, and Zane stood there and watched him and said, give me a paper to sign quick before he gets out of here and is gone.
Well, now, let me tell you, you think this sort of talk, you think it's just sort of hot air. Now,
well, the main thing is,
if you listen to it, that's the one thing I found by studying the tape. It's pretty straight information, and what they say is, and now this is a little report that they did over here, and I taped part of it on this bull, and it's the remarkable
meeting too. Well, you know.
Marvin and Miss Mary.
You can tell more from this.
I bet David's pretty. Why do?
Now, this is it. I like that.
No, we're not getting anything picked up. Well, it.
The way it had a pellet and all.
I just skipped the ordinary talk and get up to the book.
You just use that. If you go out there with some things.
That's it. Well, much sense.
Yeah.
If we were here.
He don't have enough.
Now, I want you to tell Faye about your friend that comes over there and helps us. Like you told me last night.
Who are you talking about?
Yes, he just comes over your fence.
Oh, yeah,
Brian. Who is that? That's Mr. Hogan. Bramer Boo, big old boo. Oh. Well, he comes over when he gets ready to, and I don't any of the rest of his cows bother. Oh. But he just goes to the fence and up over the gate. He comes on in, he gets himself a little syrup, maybe get him a little bite of hay, turn right around, go back home. How is that?
I said to her, why don't you and him make a little deal? He don't have enough animals, you see, to keep a bull busy like that, and you can just use that. You know what you said? Why didn't you just bring that up? It already made it.
the bull made the deal.
He's so wise. He's got so much sense.
Yeah.
If we he's in the field there, he'll stand up and he'll look at us. And if we go and load a yearling or something, he just goes right straight home and stands over the fence and looks at it.
Put the trail on the back of that truck and he'll go home.
Really?
Stand on his side and watch it, see what you're doing. If you go out there with some feed without the trailer and pass the light, he'll stay out there and help him eat it.
If I had the money, I'd lay it down that he would ain't a bull in the Lottaway County can whip him.
Oh, your bull?
No, my bull. I ain't got no bull could whip him.
Well, he tried.
He tried, but he didn't. Oh, shucks, that wasn't nothing but a...
Don't put that in the telephone.
Old man, he wanted to, but that bull just stood right up, and when that bull come on, he'd do it, get his nose and just knock him so fertile.
He just stand up there casual like?
Just stand up there and not do a thing, and he whipped our bull till he couldn't hardly get to the house.
He won't
take a
fight.
Why, Miss Mary? What's your bull? He's a
bull.
Yeah.
Oh, not too good. How are you?
Well, all fine. He just jumps the fence?
Yes, ma'am. And you know those aluminum gates there at the house?
Yeah.
Well, he wanted to put it up the house, and he went in. And he stood around and looked, and after a while he decided he wanted to go outside, so he just looked up.
Seven and you get them, little baby.
Well,
well, that's high.
I'll be here in the morning. What time you coming?
Just cleared that gate, that's right.
Okay, I'll see you.
Marvin and Curtis and Lebanon.
What's that?
I can't believe it. I never saw a door do that. I never saw a cow do that.
Okay.
Well, you don't need to buy that bull. No, I couldn't, because he's going to get rid of him. I couldn't buy him because the only reason why he would want to get rid of him is to keep from inbreeding, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't buy him because he just go over there when he got ready.
That's right.
But you know, he don't go in the woods, he don't go anywhere.
He don't know. The fence can be tore down, just one little strand of wire. And he don't pretend like he wants to get on the outside. He just comes over there at home and feeds around with our cows. He used to, in pea time, when we'd go to the fields, you know, and gather peas, he'd go to the gate and lie down and wait till we'd come out. Zane said, "Now, he bothers you all, you all don't want him over there, I'll move him." I said, "He ain't bothering us, let him alone. I don't care if him going over there, I don't care if him eating. We feed him, we buy pellets." I got into where he'd come up meat out of my hand, and I could rub his old forehead.
Yeah, that's
right. And Marvin and Zane was worried, you know, when he had to test his cows, and he said he thought he'd get the vet to give him a tranquilizer. Marvin said the old bull went and lay down in the corner of the pen, and when they got through, Zane went and put the halter on him, and the vet went up there and tested him, and he'll be lying down. He acts just like somebody, I'm telling you, he does.
I wish I could see him now.
He's
just
been a hound, hasn't he? He brought up hounds.
He had to be. Zane said when he bought him, I don't know who he bought him from. He was a little bit afraid to haul him. He had his trailer there. The trailer was all right. There wasn't nothing wrong with the trailer. But said he just knew he was going to tear it all to pieces. And when he got it, the boy put the halter on and laid him up in the trailer. And shut the gate on him. And he stood there till he got ready to go. And said, when Zane said, whenever he started the truck off with the trailer behind it, he looked back and seen the boy lay down. He just lay down all the way home. Got home, he opened the gate, and the boy got up and went So you can't beat that.
You can't beat that.
I mean, there's no walking, no milling around. You just lay down straight, still. And where is it going?
He is the best nature just those things.
And that kind of bull,
well,
I wouldn't think so.
No.
I wouldn't think so
either. Or
they
all
the same.
Yes, it depends on that.
And he don't even attempt to eat. Now, when we had our bull set to house, he'd come and he'd be over there on his side, minding his own business. And our bull would go to the fence and just bellow and paw and pick at him. And after a while, he'd just, I'm going to show him I'm not scared of him. And he'd come over there, you know, and stand up and look at our bull. And our bull would run into him, and he wouldn't do a thing to anyone but just throw him just wherever he wanted.
All you got to do is just slang his hand, and he just knocked him around.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
He didn't
want to
hurt him.
And our bull would, you know, get mad and back off, and he'd run into him again, you know, and try to whip him, and he wouldn't do a thing. He'd just take his nose and just stand up.
What he'd do, he'd just stand there and let
him. Set him over yonder on the other side.
Let the bull wear himself out. Just stand up there and knock him around a little bit.
Just slap the dab out and be so mad. And he'd be standing up there.
What a thing you could do about
it. He hadn't done a thing.
And you say, well, that's not much. It's a great deal. You see, they live with the animal. They see what he does. It's that's unusual in that it's so sustained. That's just about half of it where they're reporting on the bull. That's very unusual. I mean, they might be able to do it, but they don't ordinarily. Now, you see what the tapes do. You see when you're listening to somebody, you're listening with just about half your energy, your attention. The rest of it is you are thinking ahead or thinking back or wondering what you're going to say next, and you see, you don't listen with your whole mind. Now, on the tape, you see, you can hold it still, even listen to it at your leisure, and you see, you're under no strain. And that way, you can see more what to say. And
well, it's repetition. You can listen to it as many times as you want,
sure,
until you...
It's like you say about the movies. You know, if you want to really see what the movie says, you go to it more and more.
Yeah. First time, you're...
Even if you go for just entertainment, I want to go see The Sting again, because The Sting moves so fast that I'm sure I missed a lot of it, although I got the basic point of the story. I want to go back and see it again, because I don't know that it's true of a movie like The Sting, but I would imagine it is, that there are subtleties that you miss all along the line, which occur during the movie. Little lines that mean something if you're really familiar with the story.
Well, now this is what I learned from Debbie then. They can listen to a great deal, and come home, report on it, and take it to the typewriter, and just turn out in our time.
Mm-hmm.
It's readable, and it's pretty close to what was said. Now that's against all the theory I know. Now to get it a little better in your mind, you see, this sort of brings it up, starts bringing it up into your mind. Actually, you see, you don't know what's been said until you use it, until you look at it. And this is just the first looking at it. All right, the next day, if you go back to the typewriter, you can fill it out, straighten out your transitions, and make a few little points to see that you hadn't seen before. Well, now you do that without a tape. But you can't, I haven't been able to get started without a tape. I haven't.
Well,
now that's where the tapes go.
You couldn't do much without the tape, even if you think, I mean, you could write down something, but the chances are you're not going to remember most of what you...
You're going to remember most of that. That's what I've learned from these. That, you see, my mind has such a focus. I cut out so much, and at my stage, I can't bring it differently. But see, they haven't done that, and almost the whole 2 or 3 hours talk will just come back just as clear as be. And it's not memory. It's I don't know what it is. You see, you got faculties, you see, that you don't know what they are. Nobody knows how the mind works.
And I say, Faye Burke is our niece, who was here from Houston, and has done some things with Guy, and she's about Debbie's age. And Faye and Debbie could go over there to Miss Mary and Marvin's over here, close to Cross Creek, over there. And they would carry on this telephone conversation and talk about, what was it, She's talking like that because she didn't want to hear about that hysterectomy. But they'll do that for them where they wouldn't do it for me and God.
That's right. That's another thing.
Yeah. For the young, these natives will do that for us.
Now, one thing is her report on the television on the Patricia Hearst thing. Debbie, kind of line it up.
Oh. When she was baking biscuits, she said she knew she had it all figured out about that Patty Hearst. Had we seen the paper? And we said no. And she said, "Well, you know why she got kidnapped? You know why they took her off like that?" Oh, and Miss Mary kind of throws her head around and she says, "Why, it was that old weed fella. She just didn't want to marry that old weed fella." And we said, "Who's that? That old weed, that skinny little old fella she was supposed to marry." I saw him on the Cavott show. Little old skinny guy, he sat there and didn't say anything. Either he was scared or he didn't know what to say, and he didn't look rich to me. She just set the whole thing up so she wouldn't have to marry him.
Now that's that's right. Now, you see what that does. You say that's just comedy. It's not. I don't think. I think she's serious. I think. You see, the point I work from is that little insight that I got in the fall of 1968, where I listened to these little cassettes and what I heard on them. What I heard on them, I saw, was informative. And the information came from their experience. And on top of that, they could report on their experience. They had the faculty to report on their experience. You see, that's the one thing, that's all I do, just follow that. Now you see, so that it'll make you take it seriously and look at it. Now, you see, you don't know how they watch the television. Well, this is about as close as I've ever come to it. But see, she won't talk like that to me, but she likes young people.
Uh-huh.
And she almost acts young, doesn't she? Sort of. She feels at home with them, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
She feels at home with younger people. And now, in other words, she takes over that television program, you see, and has her own interpretation of it. And if you ever see that little weed fella,
you'll never see him again
until you
hear Miss Mary say that little old skinny weed fella.
Yeah, you believe it.
Oh, man.
That's worth an abduction, I guess.
But you know, it's amazing.
I watched that. I tried to watch that interview with that character on TV. Well, Cavett's not one of my favorite people anyway. I think he's dull. But, occasionally he has somebody good on, you know, who's more interesting than he is. But I don't know what he bothered with that guy Weed for. I mean, there was just nothing to that program.
Yeah.
Of course, maybe I was just sleepy or something and didn't want to.
Well, it was right after that. She'd been kidnapped too, and I think Weed didn't feel like just saying anything.
No.
She just needed Miss Mary's interpretive. She needed.
Right.
That's just what she ended. But you know, the amazing thing, when Wayne was talking about his own experiences, how clear he is in his. Very few people can do that, Wayne. You know, dates, and not only that, but I mean, it's sustained and.
Well, there's
and
only.
It's there, and you're not remembering it. It's just sort of there.
Well, yeah, there's. Because I'm not remembering it because I can't remember more important dates to save my life. I can't remember.
You're not trying to remember it. It's just sort of there.
But certain dates just sort of pop into your mind, like, they're not. It's not because of their relative importance.
No.
Because some of them don't even mean anything.
Yeah.
But
well,
you haven't.
You take it. You take this over into the books that you read. Now this is nothing that we do out here is. complicated, really. I mean, you don't have to be bright, too bright to follow anything we do. Well, now, there's several things. You learn to do this, the reporting, you see, and then you report at supper, and then you can report over on the typewriter. Well, your reporting, you don't want it verbatim. You want to get pretty close to it, and you want to get the transitions and be close to it. But now, one thing I remember Faye was thinking of. Miss Mary was making the biscuits and pinching them off, you see, and patting them, putting them in the pan, and mixing them up too, you see. And this and the light, and it was lightning, and she's scared as.
They all are scared of lightning.
Get out! They're scared of the weather like that. And Faye was trying to put the weather in just a little bit. And it's nice, you know, to do that. Well, you say, how would you learn to do the reporting? I think the only place you can learn to talk is from the writers of fiction. Now, I don't think fiction, most of it, is worth the time it takes to read, but they know so much about writing, and they're the only people who do. Now, that's my view. Now, you see, I'm not throwing off on anybody, but that's just my hunch. I see, that's the hunch that I work from, and that's where you pick up. One little point, you see, you don't want to change places, stay in the same place all the time. It doesn't, because every time you move, it's tedious to the people who are listening to you. The only place you learn that is from the fiction people. Well, the uses of it, well, you see, I'm interested in Miss Mary. To me, she has that wit of the countryside, which is in a way kind of close to Emma Dickinson. Well, I can show that. And what that does is you see, I'm not condescending. I have to take pains to avoid being condescending.
That's easy to be, particularly out here, Wayne. Not out here, anywhere.
Anybody
that's not in your own culture.
And there's not one in a thousand now that would look at Miss Mary and wouldn't be condescending and laugh at her and say she's a slum. That's how far out of the world has moved on since then. Now, what's happened in her case, you see, she married when she was 16. She was having to raise her aunt's children, and she married Will Guthrie, and he was 50 years old and she was 16. Well, the only thing she ever said about Will Guthrie is, he was always good to me. And what he did was, after that, she was Ms. Will Guthrie. And before that, she's just an orphan gal taking care of her aunt's children. And people feel sorry for her. But she had those gifts. And you see, and that little house, that little homestead over there in the corner, and that cattle, he butchered cattle and one thing another. And he stood well, outstanding, sort of, in the community, you see, and that preserved it. And and she is almost now, you'd say she's remodeled the kitchen, but it's still Miss Mary's kitchen. The biscuits are just like they were. And what you've got, she's almost a relic, where you can see what she was, what people have been. and what I call the qualities. Well, now that's one use of it. But now you got all sorts of uses of it. For one thing, you're making contact with people. You're dealing with a living human being, and that's very difficult to do, and not many can do it. And now one of my pet projects is what I'd like to do is have a half dozen of people like Debbie and just have them put full time or at least half time on my staff, and we'd get to talking, you see, and something would come up. Now here's one, and then I just say, well, I'll send one or two of you out and let you cover this, and they'll come in and make these same reports. Now one of them is the horse farm. You see, half of Barron County is a horse farm now. Well, it's a kind of anachronism. For one thing, they've got pasture there. They've got, say, 100 acres, 1,000 acres, and they've got it, they keep it mowed to the point there to where there's not cover for a cricket. So you've got no wildlife, no birds, nothing but horses. And horses are a destructive animal as you'll find. They destroy the pasture and bust up the fences, everything they get into. That's my feeling for a horse. Now you take those fences, they still, those big white fences, you see, that's about as far out of order now as anything you can think of. For one thing, it takes a good board to stand the sun and the rain. Well, they're not any good boards anymore, but they still make still put them boards up there, and they're costly. They don't last long, and you walk along there and you see that beautiful fence that's painted white, and you feel of it, and it's rattly, it's nails coming out.
Well, these are just various little projects that
they
can go out and report on.
The boards don't rot, they disintegrate. They're just sapwood, you see. Mm-hmm. There's not any hardwood anymore. Well, why don't they do something about it? Why don't they, you see, they are ingenious, and they've got ingenuity when it comes to the horses. Why don't they do something about that? Well, for one thing, I've tried one thing. I found that if this is the fence right along here, if you put a board out here a little bit, it keeps the horse back so he won't get up there and paw the fence. He'll paw it and bring it down. Well, I've made a gate like that down there. They were busting up a gate, so I just put one board out there to keep them. Well, you can reach the fence. Well, that's more ingenuity than they show out there at those horse farms. Of course, most of the horse farms have absentee owners, and they just interested in the real estate.
Yeah, well, most of those, well, not most of them, I guess. A lot of those horse farms are show places. They're not, they're showcases. They're a board like that to keep the horses from knocking down the fence wouldn't be cosmetic. You wouldn't want it up there. It's not pretty. Now, this friend of mine owns a horse farm down there, but his is a real horse farm. He bought some acreage down there near Bellevue, and he had this old two-story frame house on it with a tin roof, and he went in and fixed the house up on the inside, and he remodeled it on the inside, but he restored it on the outside to its original, you know, what it would look like if it had just been built.
Mm-hmm.
He has his fences up, but they're good heavy fences, and he's got two areas for the horses, and he switches them back and forth to the two areas, but he keeps the area all around the property, and especially around his house, he keeps in a nature type of condition, you know. And he's got squirrels and birds and all kinds of things.
Well, that's interesting.
He keeps the horses off.
Well, now let me tell you what.
See the horses.
Let me tell you what you do, Wayne. you see, what you do, you can just go from one farm to another and just knock around there, and you'll find somebody who'll talk to you, and you'll find, just talk to them about the maintenance of it, and you run into somebody who's interested in various parts of it. Well, you can set it down yourself, or just remember it, or else you can let them talk into the tape. They're all used to doing that, especially when it comes just to mere information like that. And what you do, you just compile it, and you get a whole lot of it there, and put it out where it's visible, and you don't have to interpret it. It'll interpret it itself, pretty much. And when you get something like that you're talking about, you see, which is exceptional, then somebody will see it. But the way it is, now I was driving along there with one of my friends. He's a brainy fellow. He's one of these learned gents, as his wife called him. And he looked over there and said, "Sure, it's pretty, isn't it?" I said, "Not me." Well, anyhow, almost anyone passing along there would say, "Isn't that pretty?" Well, if they have a little report that they read or hear about, they are.
This is the use of the
That's
yeah,
the use of it.
The use of the tape.
And you don't get that. You see, you don't get a person doesn't make contact. He's not serious. He quips and jokes and withholds information and all like that. Now I don't want to throw off, you know, and make anybody put in a bad position. But most of the talk, you see, Miss Mary's talk is informative. It's always informative. But most of the talk I hear is not. Most of it's just nervous.
What about the talk you hear, Wayne?
Oh yeah, it's the same.
Uh-huh.
Of course, the thing is, when you get so involved in your work, seems like I hardly ever have a conversation anymore that doesn't relate to work, and that's important conversation, I suppose. But
it's hardly conversation. That's just business.
It's business. It's necessary conversation, but
well, you got a lot of different kinds. Well, that's all. Now you see, if you worked with us a little while, and you know, did little assignments like this, or you wouldn't have to go and talk to Miss Mary. You could just report some of the things you do, and you get the hang of it. You'll do it with a great deal more ease, mm-hmm. and pass on a great deal more information. I mean, it just comes. You see, with just a little practice, and now that's what the tapes themselves are interesting. But basically, I think the interest is that you make the person hold still long enough where you can hear them and make contact, and then you can see you're on solid ground when you're listening. I think that's the basic thing. That's what the tapes basically mean. Now, as far as these tapes go, you see, you could just forget about them and just start all over and make some new ones if you want.
You never know where you're going to find information that's either interesting or informative to you. I was born and raised in Miami, and I've always lived in a very urban type of life, and I came up here to school on the second go-around, and I met this guy, and we became good friends, and one weekend he said, "I would really like for you to go home with me for the weekend to my folks' house." And my uncle used to live in the country, but up in Maryland, you know. And I remember I went up there while I was in high school, and I was shocked to find out that he didn't have indoor plumbing. My God, I didn't think anybody didn't have indoor plumbing, you know, being born and raised in Miami. but to simply through my own ignorance, to go out and visit with anybody in the country was just not my idea of anything to do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my idea of something to do for a weekend was go to some swinging place like Daytona Beach and, you know, and drink and have a good time. So I really didn't want to go because I knew that his parents lived in Hilliard, and his grandmother lived in Boulogne, which now Boulogne's even smaller than Hilliard, and I thought to myself, now this is just not my idea of a way to spend a weekend. But I liked him well enough that I didn't want to hurt his feelings, so I said, oh, sure, you know, we'll go to... So, I don't know, for some reason it was late at night when we finally, or it was late in the afternoon when we left there, it was late at night when we finally got there, and we decided, for one reason or another, to bypass Hilliard altogether and go straight to Boulogne. I think mainly because his parents in Hilliard didn't have any place for us to sleep, and his grandmother in Boulogne did, so... God, we drove, you know, it was up a main highway, but then we turned off this highway down this long dirt road, and then we turned down another long dirt road, and then we were on this long driveway going back into this place. And, of course, his grandmother was expecting us, so she was waiting up with all this food, you know, which I was so late at night, all I was thinking was going to sleep, but the food was delicious, and we ate, and the next morning we got up, and here I am in the middle of this beautiful farm right on the Florida line, very close to Boulogne, 12,000 acres, you know. His grandmother owns the whole thing. She doesn't approve of the marriages that her sons and daughters have made, so she won't give them any of the property. She won't let them, she won't even give them a, you know, a corner off. And she says someday it'll all be theirs. But, and I was perfectly content to spend the whole weekend there, just talking to his grandmother, walking around the farm. Now, this is not an active farm. I mean, she just lives in the middle of it. But she doesn't. She has a little garden around the house, and she has a few cows, and they can wander anywhere they want in 12,000 acres. But she's not interested in selling any of it. She doesn't need to sell it, so, you know, why should she buy it? And the parents are a little bit different story. They're very poor, very poor. The father's not in good health, and the mother doesn't work, and they live just in a little house, but in Hilliard. It's not a farm or anything. And then the other, Mike's sister lives around the corner, and she has five of the cutest daughters, and I have the best time playing with these little girls, you know. I think the youngest one is five, you know. And without sounding snobbish or anything, you get a whole new sort of view on what life is all about, you know. Life can be just as interesting to go out and spend the weekend with these people, and, well, probably more so, really, than to go to Daytona and raise cane all weekend and come back exhausted and you know. And you just get a whole new outlook on life, and you find out that that there's far more to living than to live in an apartment that's got central air conditioning and two swimming pools and drive an expensive car. You know, these people don't even have a car. They can't even afford to have a phone in their house. You know, I noticed that, for instance, that I was, you know, I don't think my mother ever, anywhere in my life, ever used lard to cook anything,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it's not supposed to be good for you.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never eaten such delicious fried chicken that was cooked in lard.
Now, if you had the chance to talk a little bit with that grandmother up there, that would change your attitude towards the world, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She lives in the middle of 12,000 acres.
Yes, just that's right.
She could,
probably
you know,
could talk, too.
Oh, yeah.
Well, now I'm going to tell you, and I got one other piece of business transaction with you. You didn't help me much on that Fort Lauderdale thing. They were eating me up on the price.
Would it be more than the price of two?
I don't know. Something might come up. I didn't ask you. Well, I don't think they'll charge you much to do the duplicating. Because the machine runs fairly fast, and
yeah.
There's no, you're not going to tie up a lot of labor time. But what's of course going to eat you up in cost is all that tape.
I don't have the tape. Oh, I mean, oh yeah, yeah.
See, I don't know how many rolls you've got that you want duplicated, but you're going to have to buy that much more tape.
Mm-hmm. Well, that tape doesn't add up.
Well, it ends up pretty fast. If you're,